Our opening words this morning are by the Reverend Otto O'Connor, a white, openly transgender minister who serves the First Parish in Malden. They are titled, On a Holy Night in 1969. On a holy night in 1969, in an inn, also known as a bar, called the Stonewall Inn, a basement which had no running water nor safe fire exits, queer people of many colors and kinds danced together, for it was the only place where they were allowed to dance, at least permitted to, by the mafia who ran the inn. In those days, it was common for police to frequent this inn, not to join in the dance, the underground celebration, but to send the dancers home and make arrests. When they would arrive, the lights would go on, the people would be lined up, and then all those in drag, all those who were trans, all those without proper identification, they were arrested and taken into custody. But on this holy night, that early morning of June 28th, the people said, not tonight. As they called them to line up, the trans women refused to go, and the police began to beat and arrest them. And as the people spilled out from the bar onto the street, Christopher Street, a crowd grew to watch. And then, as trans women, lesbians, and gay men were getting arrested, a yell came from the crowd, gay power. And as a trans woman was shoved, she shoved back, and the crowd began throwing bottles at the wagon. And suddenly, it erupted. For once, the people didn't line up. For once, the people said, no more, we've had enough. It was almost as if that night, being pulled out of the darkness of the underground at Stonewall Inn one too many times, they said, I'm ready to be seen. On this holy night, when the power of the oppressed rippled through the streets of New York, when queer people said, no more, our world will never be the same. 50 years ago, it was illegal to be gay, to be trans, to dance and to love and to celebrate. And now, only 51 years later, here we are celebrating at a church, gay and straight together, queer and straight together, trans and cis together, all in this together. And so we hear these stories of life and love and defiance and celebration. Let us also remember and pay tribute to our movement ancestors, many of them trans women of color who led the first rebellion that night. You see, Pride is the celebration of that anniversary, the anniversary of that riot at the Stonewall Inn in New York City, a holy night. So happy Pride. Welcome to this joyful celebration. Bring your whole selves, your gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer selves, your drag queen, butch and femme, cross-dressing, nail-painting, tutu-wearing selves, your genderqueer, gender-fluid, agender, pansexual, quilt-bag selves, and all the other identities that are and will be. And let's have a celebration, because joy is a rebellion too. And this church is queer, queer and fabulous. Amen. Let us begin. Our chalice lighting this morning, the words will be shared by Quincy Sprague as Peter lights the chalice here in the church.
We light our chalice flame for those who live their lives in closets of shame, for those who furtively visited the bars where nobody knew your name, for the Stonewall Riot and the fierce trans women who fought, for the plague, which still takes far too many, too young, too soon. So many gone, so many lived, so many never lived to see out gay kids singing on TV, out gay people serving in the military, marriage equality, families formed by intention. We light our chalice flame for all these and for all our siblings of the rainbow, surviving, living life out in the open with pride.
Thank you. Our opening hymn this morning is number 170. This is We Are a Gentle Angry People. The words and music are by Holly Neer, who wrote this song in response to the death of Harvey Milk. And so we sing it with pride and with purpose today.
We are a gentle angry and we are singing, singing for our lives. We are a gentle, angry people.
Thank you, Mike. That's such an important song to the movement. When I was first in seminary, I remember it being impressed upon me that there were a lot of people still in closets in our congregations, and that singing that song was one opportunity that people had to say publicly that I am gay. And so an important song for that reason, as well as for its history in the LGBT movement. Our covenant this morning is going to be led by Ken Langer. Ken, would you share the words as the rest of us speak them aloud together on mute?
Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
From all that dwell below the skies, let words of love and peace arise. Let joyful songs of praise be sung through every land, by every tongue.
And now, Director of Religious Education, Michelle Cote, will share a message for all ages.
Good morning, all. Today we celebrate Gay Pride. Normally at this time of year, there'll be lots of parades and parties as people join together celebrating their pride and being part of the LGBT community. However, due to the pandemic, all these parades haven't been canceled. Yet, that shouldn't stop the celebrations in each one of us who identify as LGBTQ. We in our church community are so accepting of people who identify as gay, trans, queer, non-binary. I see people just warmly accepting all. As was referenced in our chalice lighting and the opening words, and even in the song that we just sang, there's been a lot of negative centered around becoming and accepting who you are. And I don't want to dwell there today. I want to just talk about the pride I have for being gay and the pride that everyone who goes through that transition of accepting who they are. And I found a song this morning, actually a very last minute thing that Mike Fitzer is going to play just a part of. It's by a singer named Doma Wilson, who is lesbian. And I'd like to share just a part of that song with you. Go ahead, Mike.
I want to be me, who I really am, not who you want me to be. I love who I am. Yes, I'm different, and that's what I want you to see. I'm not like other girls. I don't like tight jeans. I don't wear tight shirts. I don't like wearing heels. I don't like how it feels. I don't wear tight skirts. I am myself, and that's never gonna change. I'ma be myself, and I'ma love myself no matter what you may say. Cause I'm gay and proud, and I'm loud. Being fake is not my style. Go ahead and hate from the other side, cause we running things right now. All my life, people told me, like, just dress like a girl. Try to date another boy, hey, he might bring you joy. You really might rock your world. You haven't found it yet, nah. Haven't found the right one. Your kid needs a father figure in his life. Hey, he can father your son. My son has 2 months, loud and proud, and no, I am not ashamed. And he will take up for his mamas if you slander our name. LGBT, stand up proud. We got an army this way. It's not a choice to live this life. You know I always been gay. I wanna be me, who I really am, not who you want me to be. I love who I am. Yes, I'm different, and that's what I want you to see. I love who I love. I wear what I wear. I'm proud to be me. No longer living in the dark. I'm proud to be free.
So I heard those words, and they just, the song goes on for much longer. And typically, this would not be the music that I would choose to listen to. It's not the genre that I'm drawn to. But I was so proud to hear of someone being so proud of themselves. And I think that that's one of the most powerful messages that we can give ourselves and our children and youth. To say what Dama Wilson said, I love who I am. Yes, I'm different, and that's what I want you to see. I love who I love. I wear what I wear. I'm proud to be me. No longer living in the dark, I'm proud to be free. On this day, I just want to uphold the pride that I feel in myself for being gay. I want to uphold the pride that I feel for those adults and youth who join me in their own celebration of being proud to be themselves each and every day, but especially today. And mostly, more than anything else, I want to continue to have a community that accepts, affirms, and upholds each and every person who travels this road to self-acceptance and pride, and where they can say with joy and love, I am proud to be me. Thank you.
Let's take a moment in silent witness, prayer, meditation. Spirit of life, it's sometimes asked, is pride a protest or a party? And such it is, both. A time right now when we celebrate and we mourn, when we remember our history, when we long for justice. We come together at this time of year with hearts full and hearts excited, with hearts heavy, with emotions high and low. And two, at this time of year, we remember the intersectional nature of oppression, and particularly those people who are struggling for racial equality right now in our country. We remember the ways in which the halls of power are still working to deny people their rights. And we commit ourselves to a path towards justice, and a path towards an ever-increasing love. May it be so. Amen. I wanted to tell you a bit of the story today, the story of the Unitarian Universalist history in the struggle for LGBT rights, and put it a little bit in the context of the national struggle, but mostly tell you things about our movement and what it's done. I don't know if this is old news or familiar news or new news to all of you, maybe a bit of a mixture for some it's one and some it's the other. Most of the information I'm going to share here was gathered by the UU Rainbow Project, which is a project of the retired UU Ministers and Partners Association, otherwise known as IRMAPA. It's doing some great work and has these wonderful archives with interviews of these early groundbreaking figures in LGBT history in UUism. Now, Pride is at this time of year, of course, because of the Stonewall riots, which happened in 1969, or the Stonewall uprising, we might call it, as we learn that the word riot is politicized against people. That same year, for the first time, a minister of a major religious group, and major religious group meaning, I guess, about as large as Unitarian Universalism, declared himself in the United States publicly to be gay. And that was a Unitarian Universalist minister, the Reverend James Stoll. Now, sadly, our first out gay minister in Unitarian Universalism and the first out gay minister of any major denomination in the U.S. never served a church after coming out. So as much as we can count this as a first in our movement, it also had its sad side. But he led the way for us as an association, and the next year he co-authored the first resolution passed in our General Assembly. And that was the year I was born, actually, in 1970. And it called on congregations to end discrimination against homosexuals and bisexuals. And it called for us also to begin sexuality education work as an association, which we then did. The very next year, in 1971, we had the beginnings, the creation of the groundbreaking AYS, About Your Sexuality curriculum. AYS was the precursor to OWL, Our Whole Lives, which is the curriculum we use today. And it was groundbreaking not only for being a comprehensive sexuality education curriculum that was being offered by a denomination, but while we now have it taken for granted that we have this sexuality curriculum that teaches our youth and adults about healthy attitudes towards sexual orientation and gender identity, it was groundbreaking then, not only for its sexuality education more generally, but because it came out of the growing LGBT movement within Unitarian Universalism, and it presented gay and lesbian sex as normal as sacred in that curriculum. And then in 1973, we created a department in the UUA, a groundbreaking department called the UU Office of Gay Affairs. Now, that unfortunate name would be changed rather soon thereafter to the Office of Gay and Lesbians Concerns. It wasn't without a struggle that we created this department in Unitarian Universalism. There was a proposal also made at the General Assembly that year that would have made great statements but not created an office. And then there was an effort led by the same people to get the Board of Trustees to defund the office. But those were both defeated, and it became an official part of our association thereafter that we were a religion that was open and welcoming to gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, and then later including transgender people as well. A 1975 effort again to end the Office of Gay and Lesbian Concerns was resoundingly defeated. It would be a whole decade after that first gay minister came out in our association, though, before the first gay men and then later lesbians were called to serve Unitarian Universalist congregations. The year after Harvey Milk's murder and the design of the rainbow flag in 1978, and as Holly Neer was writing, We Are a Gentle, Angry People, in 1979, the Reverend Douglas Morgan Strong was called to serve Augusta, Maine, and the Reverend Mark Bellatini was called to serve in San Francisco as an interim associate minister. We passed a resolution at General Assembly the next year calling on the UUA and the UUMA and other bodies to assist in settling openly gay ministers, because it was not easy for them to get pulpits in those days when they were openly gay. The first openly lesbian ministers were called a few years later, the Reverend Barbara Peskin in Oak Park, Illinois in 1984, and the Reverend Kim Crawford Harvey to Provincetown in 1985. UU ministers were already performing same-sex marriages. Mark Bellatini did his first one in that first year he was called, and he remembers it saying these words. He says, I did my first such ceremony at the First Church in San Francisco in July of 1979. I had never seen such a ceremony before, so I created one from scratch. As I processed up the aisle to the altar in front of the two men, I wept. I felt as if I had lived to see the dawn of what some Jews call the Messianic Age, and what the New Testament refers to as the realm or way of God. I felt that the whole world was created new, and that justice actually had a chance to exist in reality, not as an abstraction. Later, he says, later when I found out that Harry Schofield, minister emeritus of that very church, had performed such ceremonies back in the 1950s, when no one could even think of such a thing, I wept again for the sheer compassion and courage he showed without anyone around him to support him. I'll talk more about the more recent marriage history struggle in a bit, but there are some other things to talk about in the 1980s. Celeste DeRoche, partner of the Reverend Gail Geisenhainer and compiler of this UU history, writes, "These out UU ministers were coming into ministry in the earliest days of the AIDS epidemic, 1984, 1985. Kim Crawford Harvey's interview is especially searing in its description of what these years were like in Provincetown and the crucial role that the UU church played in the lives of gay men. At many points, the only two people in that the gay community could turn to were Kim and one funeral director who was willing to accept the bodies of men who had died from AIDS." Here's a piece of Kim Crawford Harvey's story in which she has gone out in a boat with a member of her church, Paul Richards, in the height of the AIDS epidemic. Kim says these words. She says, "Paul motored way, way out into the bay until the leaning steeple of the church took its place in Provincetown's silhouette on the horizon. He threw the anchor and we sat there in silence. From a distance, the dying and death, the loss and grieving all took their place. And then Paul said to me, 'Listen, in all this madness, even if it kills every single one of us and there's no one left to tell the stories, it matters that we love each other well.'" I'm pleased to say that the UUA had a strong response to the AIDS epidemic. The UUA created an AIDS working group in 1986, and it added HIV positive status to its non-discrimination clause for hiring. In 1989, the UUA General Assembly created the Welcoming Congregation Program, which was created, and the vast majority of UU congregations have participated in since to become more welcoming to LGBT people. We passed two resolutions related to HIV/AIDS. And in those years, we were doing a lot of work protesting states that had sodomy laws that were on its books used to criminalize the gay community. These were my teen years and young adult years at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And so I can share the kids who were growing up UU in those days were growing up in a denomination that told them in no uncertain terms that it was okay to be gay, it was celebrated to be gay, and that your sexuality and your gender identity were all precious, sacred, worthy, and made you a whole being, not a fractured being. I remember later in an LGBT advocacy workshop as a minister in the early days of my ministry that we were broken into dyads and asked to recount how and why we had gotten involved in LGBT advocacy. For me, as someone who had grown up UU, I never remembered a time when I thought being gay wasn't okay. It was always okay in the faith that I was in, and it was always celebrated in the faith I was in. And as for why we fought for this, my response was, this is something Unitarian Universalists do. This is at the heart of our faith. The question of why I believe this or when I had come to...
For those of you still on, Cindy might be having some technology problems. She'll be right back. You have not lost your connection.
We lost connectivity here at the church for a second, but I am back. I don't know where I left off, though, before we lost connectivity. I always come over to church to do my sermon because it has better Wi-Fi than my home, but now I'm questioning that decision. I'm going to just back up a paragraph here and say, I share this history of my own history in here because it's a wonderful thing to have grown up in this faith and to know this your whole life. And it's something that makes our faith so important today because the fight for rights and equal treatment isn't done. And it's important to our young people that we continue in this faith to be such a wonderful and welcoming place. In the 1990s, our movement was involved in the fight to allow LGBT people in the military. We were continuing to fight for comprehensive sexuality education in schools and continuing our support of people with AIDS. And the list of milestones in our ministry and in our movement starts to include LGBT ministers dying of AIDS as well. And so I want to lift up and remember Mark Mosher DeWolf, who died in 1988, Bernie Kruger, who died in 1989, and Newell Deany Starr, who died, Dean Starr, who died in 1996. While congregations were becoming welcoming congregations, it still was not easy for our ministers. And everywhere, and it still isn't today, everywhere they're settled, they're still the first, oftentimes, the first in their church, in their town, in their community. And it was really true then in the 1990s. In the 1995, my friend Marlene Walker went through negotiated resignations after she was outed in a local paper after having participated in a protest. And she received phone calls threatening her life and her children's lives. It was 1996 when we included finally transgender in the office title, in the title of the offices of bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgender concerns at the UUA. By that point, there were only 57 welcoming congregations across the country. But in 1999, we got to the point where at least one state, Montana, had all of its congregations as welcoming congregations. Now, unfortunately, there are not all that many UU congregations in Montana, and we still had a long way to go. The Reverend Sean Dennison, around then, the first openly trans minister in our movement called to a congregation, he started his seminary in 1996, the same year I did. He says of that time, "I came out in seminary, which was an amazingly supportive place. I was scared to death to come out, and I tried to cover it with bluster. I told the president of the school, 'You and this seminary are going to have the privilege of watching me transition from female to male.' I totally didn't believe it myself and thought I would be kicked out. To her credit, the president, the Reverend Dr. Rebecca Parker, leaned forward and said, 'How wonderful. Tell me about it.' She then invited the entire faculty, staff, and student body to her home for the showing of a trans-positive documentary and Q&A with Jameson Green. Sean continues, "When I expressed gratitude for all she was doing, and she said, 'It's not your job to educate this school. It's mine.'" Sean would get called to his first congregation in 2002. In the 2000s, our advocacy for justice continued and the marriage equality movement strengthened. Many ministers, including myself, vowed in those days not to sign any licenses until we could sign them for everyone. And finally, in 2004, here in Massachusetts, we gained marriage equality with the state of Goodrich versus the Department of Public Health. That case, led by two Unitarian Universalist women, Hillary and Julie Goodrich, galvanizes Unitarian Universalists across the state and the country. Hillary Goodrich was the director of the UU funding program. And when marriage equality is declared here, the president of the UUA, the Reverend Bill Sinkford, performs the first ceremony for that couple. A potent example of the need for marriage equality was experienced in our movement the year before when the Reverend Bob Wheatley, the former director of the Office of Gay and Lesbian Concerns, died. When he died in 2003, his partner Kenneth was prohibited by Mount Auburn Hospital from claiming his body or making any decisions. The Reverend Gene Navias tells Bob's and Kenneth's story, saying this, "Who are you?" the hospital demanded when Kenneth presented himself. "I'm his life partner," Kenneth said. "You have no status," they told him. "We need the name of a relative to identify him and give us direction for what to do with his body." "I've been with him for 52 years, Kenneth replied. "He has no living relatives." "Prove it," the hospital staffer responded. "He wanted to be cremated," Kenneth said. "You have no power to authorize his cremation. You may be wanting to cover up evidence about his death. We'll put his body in the morgue until we get some reliable direction." Gene Navias continues, "Kenneth was grief-stricken and distraught when he called me at 7 a.m. to tell me what had happened. I found a lawyer to help him, but there was not a lot of help to be found. Bob had never given Kenneth power of attorney, made out a medical proxy, or any other legal document. His will was inadequate to express his request for cremation. Kenneth called a crematorium, which said they couldn't pick up the body until it was released by the hospital. No, they would not release Bob's body. Every day and several times a day, Kenneth called me, Jean writes, grieving over the fact that, as he said, Bob's body is still lying on a cold slab. That went on day after day for over a week until the hospital gave in. They didn't want the body anymore, and they were willing to bend the rules. But for every step forward, as we gained marriage equality across the land, there was one step back or more. After Massachusetts declared marriage equality, numerous other states responded with constitutional amendments prohibiting same-sex marriage. After performing legal weddings here in Massachusetts in 2004, I moved that summer to Michigan, one of those states where we wrote discrimination into law. So while Massachusetts led the way, the battle was on everywhere else, and Unitarian Universalists were engaged in that fight. As the fight went to Iowa, the young man at that time, Zach Walls, spoke in front of the Iowa House and Senate talking about his two gay moms. Zach Walls was a Unitarian Universalist youth at the time. And in 2007, a Unitarian Universalist minister, a classmate of mine, the Reverend Mark Stringer, performed the first same-sex wedding in Iowa during an hours-long window of time between when the state legalized same-sex weddings and when a stay of that decision was put into place. It's a playbook we learned from, and when in 2014 there was a similar window of less than 24 hours between the federal district court legalizing same-sex marriage in Michigan on a Friday and when the stay was put into place late on Saturday, only four counties opened specially on Saturday to start issuing licenses, but the Unitarian Universalists were ready. 300 couples got married in that window of time in Michigan, and over 200 of those couples were performed by UU ministers. 120 of them alone were performed by the Reverend Kimmy Regal, who was the only minister performing them in the Detroit suburbs, the one in Oakland County, the only Detroit area county where marriage certificates were being issued. And she performed mass weddings, groups at a time, working hand in hand with the county clerk to get those licenses issued, weddings performed and signed and filled out in time. Our state refused to recognize those weddings, but that case in Michigan was one of the groups of cases that went on to the Supreme Court. When marriage equality came to Arkansas, the Reverend Jenny Barrington drew parallels to the Little Rock Nine, saying, "We all drive by Central High School at the time. It's an icon. I do think we are all influenced by the history in Little Rock and the state and in the South as regards racial conflict. This is an opportunity to stand on the side of love and do the right thing, the respectful and supportive thing, rather than taking a stand blocking basic human rights." It was during Pride Month, actually, while the General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist was in session, that marriage equality was proclaimed by the Supreme Court and became the law of the land. And it was a joyous thing to see Unitarian Universalists, some of whom were those first gay and lesbian and transgender ministers, and those who created the Office of Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Concerns and staffed it for so many years, and those who struggled through the AIDS epidemic and lost so many loved ones, and all those who had fought so hard for marriage equality. So many of them, so many of us, Unitarian Universalists, gathered together, able to celebrate together when that law passed through the land. Today, we have so much to celebrate. We have openly gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, gender non-binary ministers serving our congregations and religious educators leading our children and youth programs. We have had our whole lives teaching health attitudes towards sex, sexuality, and gender identity and before at AYS for generations. We have marriage equality across the country. There is so much to celebrate, and Unitarian Universalists have been fighting for this for so long, and there's every reason that Pride should be a happy, celebratory affair. And yet, trans ministers still struggle in our association, and trans people struggle in this country enormously. Just this week, the president rolled back transgender protections in healthcare, and he did it not only during Pride Month, but on the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shootings. It's only been a few years since those shootings, and as our country during this Pride Month is in a turmoil of protests about the killing of Black people, we have to remember the intersexual relationship between these two oppressions. We have to remember that it was largely Latino gay men who were killed in the Pulse nightclub, and that it's so often trans people of color who are killed in the U.S. and around the world every year still. We have to remember that just as Reverend Barrington connected that answering the call of love for LGBT people is connected to civil rights for people of color. So Pride this year must still be a protest. Until every protection afforded to heterosexual and cisgender people is afforded to LGBT people, and until that includes LGBT people of all races, Pride must be both celebration and protest, and we must continue on in this fight in our movement. And so I want to recall again those words Kim shared from her congregant, Paul Richards. Listen, in all this madness, even if it kills every single one of us and there's no one left to tell the stories, it matters that we love each other well. Amen. But I end saying we are not done telling the stories of those who paved the way, and we are still here fighting. And without those stories, without those people who paved the way, we would not be here today. And we remember their stories and we pay gratitude to them. And we will continue on the path that they started, continue to answer the call of love. May it be so. Please join me in singing. I want to let you know now as we sing this closing song, Answering the Call of Love, that when we do our postlude in a few minutes, I'm going to we're going to like highlight different people's screens as we sing that song together. We're not going to do it during this hymns because you're going to hear Mike singing, but during the postlude, we're going to do that. So if you want to not have your screen highlighted so that we can kind of show them to the community, I invite you to turn off your video, and that'll be an indication to us that you wish to be a little bit more anonymous in the service today.
We are answering the call.
And so let us go forth today, proclaiming love, proclaiming it in the streets, proclaiming it in our homes, proclaiming it on social media, everywhere we go, the power of love, the core of our faith. Let us carry it with us, proclaim it to the world, and may it become true that we are truly answering the call of love. Everyone, for coming today. Happy Pride, and so glad to have you all here with us. It was so wonderful to see all the rainbows that you brought onto the screens. I'm going to just divide us into breakout rooms here for our virtual coffee time. I guess I shouldn't really call it off coffee hour because it's not a whole hour, but we're going to do this for 15 to 20 minutes. So those who are interested in staying to chat with people, just remain on the line for a minute. I should say that if you are both using both a phone and a computer to be in here, you may be separated into two different rooms. So you probably want to close the device that you're not using to listen so that you don't get confused about who you're talking to. And those breakout groups will begin in just a minute. And once again, thank you to everyone who helped participate today and to our Zoom and tech team as well. Much appreciated.